We begin our series on summer gun violence across Illinois by looking at our capital city, Springfield. Springfield's had a nearly threefold increase so far this year in the number of people killed or injured by gunfire.
Most of these kids that you see that commit these dollars, they're really trying to be a part of something, but they're trying to be a part of something the wrong way.
What's going on in Springfield and what are city and community leaders doing to try to prevent gun violence? Mayor Jim Langfelder joins us to discuss how he hopes to get local businesses and the community involved. Plus, Illinois isn't the first state to ever go without a budget, even though we're the longest running without one. We'll talk with Chicago Magazine reporter Yana Kunichav about what Illinois lawmakers can learn from other states that have gone through this before. We'll also hear the latest on budget negotiations with IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Summer is a time when cities often see an increase in gun violence. Here in Illinois, this isn't just a problem in Chicago. All this summer on the 21st, we're going to be going to communities across the state and talking to community and political leaders and residents about what they're doing to try to prevent gun violence. We begin today with our state capital, Springfield. In the past 6 months, Springfield police have received nearly 100 reports of shots fired. 30 people have been injured. 4 of those victims have died. Last year at this time, just one person had died because of gun violence. The State Journal Register reports that more than a dozen of this year's shootings were just in the month of May. I'm joined now on the line by the mayor of Springfield, Jim Langfelder, and the chief of Springfield's Police Department, Ken Winslow. Mayor Langfelder, Chief Winslow, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Mayor Langfelder,
are you there? Mayor Langfelder, can you hear me? Hi, good morning, Mayor. How are you?
Tune into this real quick.
Mayor, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah,
looks like we're having a problem getting a hold of Mayor Langfelder. Chief Winslow, are you there?
I'm here.
Good morning, Chief. Thanks for being with me. I imagine if you calculate these numbers, which I know you have, it would be a threefold increase going from one death to the 4 that's already happened in Springfield. I suspect you would say that one is too much, Chief.
Absolutely. And that's 4 deaths by gunfire this year.
Correct. Yes. Yes. What would you say, what sense do you have is behind this recent spike that you've seen in the number of reported, and what I'm talking about, just not just the fatalities, but the numbers of injuries and the reports of shots fired?
Yeah, what we're seeing right now is we have 2 rival groups or
I can hear
gangs that are feuding back and forth, and they've been responsible for about 40% of the shots fires called this year. Obviously, these two are feuding back and forth over various reasons. Some stuff very petty to some stuff that somebody considered a little more serious as retaliation for a previous shooting.
And Chief Winslow, would you say these shootings have been concentrated in specific neighborhoods?
It's been across the community, but you know, the vast majority have occurred in our what we call Quad 4 or parts of our East Side community.
And can you, for folks outside of Springfield, can you explain a little bit more about that?
Basically, our city's broken up into 8 beats and 4 quads. So basically, it would be the southeastern portion of the community.
The southeastern portion of Springfield. Mayor Langfelder, are you with us now?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can. Good morning. Thank you for taking the time to be with us, Mayor. I wanted to get sort of your initial sense of how you're feeling right now about the numbers that we've seen, not just the numbers, of course, but the fatalities that we've seen so far this year in Springfield.
Well, it's very concerning, even if you just have one. But as the chief alluded to, these are just drive-by situations. People are at the wrong place at the wrong time. So it's very concerning, even with one. And so that's what we're trying to address to make sure future ones don't happen.
One of those incidents, Mayor, I wanted to ask you in particular, the We, according to the news reports from State Journal Register, wanted to ask you about 13-year-old Savannah Wilson was accidentally shot and killed by her 12-year-old friend. What do we know about that incident, Mayor?
Well, it's from my understanding, fortunately, he had a weapon and, was playing around and, it turned into a tragic situation. And so really what the initiatives we're trying to go forward with is twofold. One is educating our young people and then also giving them avenues where, you know, they don't fall prey to other individuals that would have influence and steer them down the wrong path. We're trying to make sure they make good choices moving forward.
Chief, you were talking about drive-bys. I know in another incident, Sheena Malone was shot and killed. She was 28. She was 6 months pregnant. And in retaliation for that, the next day, there were shots fired, and then a 19-year-old Andre Booker, the third, was killed. Chief, I know it's hard. I wonder, as you're talking about sort of this cycle of retaliation, what is the police department trying to do to maybe once there's a shooting, you know, maybe you know there's going to be a retaliation? What kind of things is the department doing to try to stop that?
Well, we are deploying a combination of traditional policing, which includes, suppression details, directed patrols. I'm not going to get into every little thing that we're doing. Obviously, we don't want to tip our hand to people who may be listening that may be involved in such activity, but also some non-traditional avenues such as custom notifications where we're making contact with the members of the rival groups or gangs that we believe to be involved or possibly involved or related to these shootings, speaking to their parents, speaking to people who may have some kind of influence over them to convince them that retaliation isn't the right way to go and to cooperate with the investigation, let my detectives and our department put the case together. We've shown over and over again that with the community support and forthcoming of information that we can quickly close these cases and bring them to successful resolution. So that's the key there, is telling them that let us handle it. Don't take it out on your, don't take it back into your own hands and try to do something that's just going to endanger somebody else and get yourself in trouble. So, but something I do want to clarify is that, you know, these are not random incidents. These are targeted incidents. You know, all these things have been targeted with the exception of the Savannah case. In that case, there was basically an accidental shooting where a child is in possession of a firearm. And unfortunately, when you put children, a firearm in a child's hand, that you have the recipe for tragedy. And that's what occurred on that incident there. So, but these other incidents, they're not targeted. They're not going around and just randomly targeting people. They are targeting specific people who are associates of these groups.
And Chief, you mentioned the community. I wanted to ask you about your relations with the community, with different community organizers. How crucial is that to helping solve this problem?
You know, as I tell people all the time, this is not just a law enforcement problem. This is a community problem. We see it throughout communities across our country. Whether Chicago, St. Louis, or even departments our own size, or whether it's Peoria, Rockford, et cetera, we see a lot of the same things. And a lot of times what we're seeing is a breakdown in the social structure of our community that contributes to a lot of this. You know, where are the children? Where are the parents? Are the parents involved? Are they engaging their children? Do they know what their children are out there doing, et cetera? In addition to that, you know, you take in the socioeconomics issue and a multitude of other reasons and other things that play into this. And this is something that the police department cannot do upon itself. And that's been proven over and over. So what it's going to take is a multidisciplinary approach by the stakeholders of this community to come together. And part of that is, you know, the parents, it's our social services, it's our neighbors and people in the community that are witnessing things and not coming forward to take a stand and say that we're not going to allow violence to occur in our community, specifically gun violence, and that we are going to fight back actively and aggressively toward this type of behavior. Because if we don't, then the problems will continue to thrive in those exact communities.
That's Springfield Police Chief Ken Winslow. We're talking about, Chief, I appreciate you bringing up the multidisciplinary approach. You mentioned socioeconomic factors. Mayor, I want to talk to you about that in a minute, but I just want to stay on the community relations for a second and ask, Chief, do you feel like you guys are doing a good job building trust with the community? How would you characterize the relationship right now between the Springfield Police Department and particularly, as you're saying, in this quadrant?
Well, we are working hard to continue to build partnerships throughout the community. We've done a great job over the last few years of reaching out to the community to build trust and show them what our department is about. But it's a two-way street, you know, and a lot of the people that we're building trust with are not the members of these groups that are out there causing violence in our community. Those are the 10-15% of our community who don't want interaction with the police, who don't want the police out there doing their job because it interferes with their way of life and their means of survival. So with that, though, is we are building trust with the rest of the people in the community, working hard together to work together to solve this issue.
Mayor, what's your sense of looking at relationships between not just the police department and the community, but even with offices such as yourself and the mayor's office?
Well, I've been mayor 2 years, and Chief Winslow, he went through my interview process, and part of that was we made the rounds throughout our community and had public forums on what they'd like to see in a police chief. So we got the community feedback at that point in time. But Chief Winslow, he brought that perspective. It's really a new mentality when it comes to policing, where you have to be engaged with the community. And so that's the direction we're taking. Another thing we put in place is ward plan meetings. And so we're divided into 10 wards. We have 10 aldermen. We have ward meetings in each section of our community and ask the community to give us feedback on what type of city they would like us to become and get their ideas. So instead of us going and kind of talking to them, it's more responsive where we're getting their feedback. And that's really helped build that level of trust or that community relationship. But those community outreach efforts continue on each and every day. We're trying to perfect things online, get people engaged, you know, through text messaging or through our website and things of that nature, especially with social media. That's something that you always try to perfect and will continue to strive towards.
I want to ask you about that in a second, Mayor, but I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well, as we've been talking about the community. Reggie Dale is a community organizer. He's an activist with Faith Coalition for the Common Good in Springfield, where he also works for criminal justice reform. Reggie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good
how
morning,
you doing,
Reggie.
How you doing, Mayor?
How you doing, Reggie?
Good. You, Reggie?
All righty.
So it sounds like you guys know each other. Reggie, I want to ask you, what are you hearing from residents in these neighborhoods where the shootings have taken place? What's the sense of how people are feeling right now?
They are absolutely terrified. You know, a lot of them have got to the point where they're just scrambling, trying to worry about it, keep their own household safe. You know, a lot of people, they used to attend different kind of social functions and do things in the community to stop doing that because they don't know when the flare-up of violence is going to come back. Just know it's all sporadic. You know, we can have a calm week, and then we can have a bloody week the next day or two. So, you know, right now, we just, everybody is kind of scrambling and trying to find ways to keep our community safe, you know, come together collectively and think of things that we can do, you know what I'm saying, to continue on this path with no gunshots fired.
Reggie, as you say that, it sounds like a really tough situation. I wonder if we're thinking particularly about older residents in those neighborhoods. Do you have people who are actually afraid to go outside?
Oh, definitely. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. There's definitely people in my own family, you know, people that I'm in communications with every day that don't go about their daily living as they did a few months ago.
Reggie, what do you think is behind the uptick that we've seen so far this year in the number of shootings and reports of shots fired and, unfortunately, even with fatalities in Springfield?
I mean, it would take probably the rest of the day for me to dig it all out. But to piggyback off of what the chief said earlier, it is a structure breakdown, but it's not a structure breakdown of our community. That's the last part of it. You know, it's been a structure breakdown of our country for so many centuries, you know. So it's all systemic, you know. But now we're speaking about micro and what's going on right here in our community. So, yes, there is a breakdown in our structure. It's a breakdown of the black structure of family in our homes, first of all, you know, because most of the kids that we're talking about that's at risk of this involved with this violence is coming from broken homes. You know, they don't have two parents at home. They have one parent dead, one parent locked up, or two parents cracked out, but some kind of way, you know, it's coming from this systemic thing that's been put in place for over so many decades. So this is not something that we should be surprised. We should have seen it coming, so I'm making some kind of prevention measures way before now. But however, right now it's something that we have to deal with as collectively, like the chief say. You know, it's just not on the authority figures. It's going to be on our clergy. It's going to be on our community. It's going to be on the parents. It's going to be on everybody. Everybody got to come together, and we definitely, you know, got to come up with solutions, you know, stand in combat there.
Reggie, for your perspective as someone who's in the community, as someone who has, you know, dealt with this firsthand, we just have about a minute or so before we take a break, and we're going to continue this conversation. I wonder if briefly you could just start to answer, what do you think your responsibility is as a community activist? What kind of solutions would you like to see? Or would you propose, I should say?
I would like to see the city of police come together. I mean, the city of Springfield come together as a whole and get people like myself that used to be involved with the gang, that's been involved with the shooting, that has turned their life around and is willing to pay back forward their blessing. You know, we've reached out to these different variations of officials and stuff and let them know that we're on board. But I want to commend Mayor Lanfield because we just met with him last week, my Cujo team, and we're moving forward on a couple of initiatives. So I want to commend him on that. But you definitely got to get the component of the people in the community that these two fractions or these fractions, so we don't know how many fractions it is. It's going to be two main fractions and a couple of copycat fractions. But however, we got to get the trust of these young kids. You know, if they don't trust the authority figures, you put people in place that they do trust that can reach them. You know, and that's when guys like myself come in, because we're already door-to-door going in to talk to the grandmamas, the moms, the uncles. You know, we're talking to these individuals that are allegedly, you know what I'm saying, responsible for these bombs. We are in conversations with them as we speak, so we got to keep people like Cujo involved.
So Cujo is the task force that Reggie Dale is leading, Communities United for Justice and Order. It's part of Faith Coalition for the Common Good in Springfield. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation, not just with Reggie. I want to have Mayor Langfelder and Chief Winslow have a chance to also talk a little bit about, respond to what Reggie's saying and talk a little bit about this. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. You can tweet to us at 21STShow as we're talking about gun violence in Springfield. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this summer, we'll be taking a look at communities across Illinois and how they're coping with gun violence. Contrary to what you might think, this isn't just a problem in Chicago. Today, we're taking a look at our state capital, Springfield. So far this year, Springfield's had an increase in the number of people wounded and killed by gun violence, also reports of shots fired to police. In the past 6 months, Springfield police have received more than 100 reports of shots fired. We've got 4 people who have already died so far this year. Last year, this time, just one person had died because of gun violence. On the line with me from Springfield, Springfield's Mayor Jim Langfelder, police chief of the police department, Chief Winslow. Ken Winslow is with us. And Reggie Dale, who's a community activist and organizer. He's been talking about the community's role in all of this. Mayor Langfelder, I know that at last week's city council meeting, this issue of gun violence was front and center. You called on everyone to propose what you said were tangible solutions. And I wanted to ask, as the police chief alluded to earlier, obviously this isn't just a law enforcement issue. He mentioned socioeconomic factors. We often hear about the need for summer youth employment and things like that. I wonder what kind of anti-violence initiatives you're working on specifically in Springfield to try to address this issue.
Well, prior to the shootings starting up or escalating, Pastor Hale had spoke to me about a Phoenix program that he had put in place under my father, which was back in the 90s when he was mayor, as geared more towards youth employment. And at this time, we didn't have funds in the budget, and so we were planning for next year. especially with those type of activities. Alderman Turner and Senor met with me, as well as Pastor Held, the Minister Alliance, and other nonprofit organizations towards that initiative and assess what we have available right now. But with the escalations of the shootings and especially the killings, we said we can't wait. We can't afford to wait. It's, you know, it's a crisis situation that we need to try to address as quickly as possible. So one of the things we've done is I've called on some business leaders that I know, and they've contributed up to $35,000 so far for youth initiatives. The other side of it is the city council did vote to allocate $100,000 in community development block grant funds. Of course, you have to go by the federal guidelines to administer those funds, but that'd be for youth initiatives. And so what we're trying to do is create the support systems, I think, that Reggie had alluded to, is what's in place already. You don't want to duplicate. You want to see if, like, the YMCA Boys and Girls Club, the school district, the park district, if they have a waiting list of people that can't afford to use those services, we can help get them into those programs. What we're trying to do is figure out a way to get as many youth off the streets this summer and into structured activities as much as possible. But, of course, there's the other side of it, I think Reggie was alluding to, that they are not going to go to the structured programs and things of that nature. So we did have a meeting at the Salvation Army last week. It's a former Gold's Gym, and we spoke. You know, what was good is we had a great turnout of people that care about what's happening in the community and have more concrete plans in place. They're going to submit any ideas they have, and then we'll have to make a determination of which ones we can move forward with this year to address the situation.
Reggie, do you feel like those proposals, the mayor's talking about different forums, do you feel like what people, do you have a sense that you feel like people in the community, their solutions are being heard? Do you feel like those channels are open?
I'm thinking that just now, I mean, within the last probably week or so, that we've getting on the same page as the mayor just spoke on. You know, he has started to involve the community more, people that's grassroots, like the Cujo organization, that actually got relationships. We are building relationships with the victims and the family of the suspects, you know, in this situation, you know, because, you know, they are victims also. When you get a family, when the son gets locked up, you know, he's been taken from his family too. There's a lose-lose. There's no win in this situation at all. So, yes, here right now, we're at the beginning stages of putting together mentoring programs and being able to identify, because you get a lot of these youngsters that they want to do right. They actually want to do right, you know what I'm saying? So when we sit up here and say we've identified so many of these alleged gang members, we need to also know that, you know, everybody should be held accountable the same way the next one should, because you got some of these kids are just following us and they need a way out. And again, they are not going to be subjected or receptive to these different programs that are already in place, like, you know what I'm saying, the Boys and Girls Club, NAACP programs, and different organizations that's already here in place, because they are the other. They are different kind of kids, and they got to be mentored, they got to be handled, and they got to be dealt with people that understand them and they can relate to. So that's what we're in place right now, trying to put those entities together so this summer, like the mayor said, we can start separating them, put them where, because we send them to one of these programs that's already put together, and then they're back on the street feeling even more rejected because they didn't last there or they were there too corrupt of the kids. So we got to make a separation.
Yeah. Chief Winslow, I wonder Reggie's distinction, and I wonder from a law enforcement perspective how, if difficult it is to do that, to distinguish between, as he's saying, the kids who maybe are in gangs who are just following or maybe not necessarily the ones who are committing the crimes. From a law enforcement perspective, do you make that distinction? That sounds like a tough, is that a tough thing to do?
Well, we look at the actual incident. So if there's a crime committed, what role did that person play in that crime? What we've been doing is exactly what Reggie's talking about. We've, as well as it sounds like him and his people, have been reaching out to the victims of these incidents, as well as the known members that we have identified. And I don't claim that we've identified everybody. We surely haven't. But we've been reaching out to their families, as I stated earlier, doing what we refer to as custom notifications, talking about that they've been identified for various reasons due to data, et cetera, that point to their child or their loved one being involved in this activity. And with that, we offer them a two-way message. One message is that please take the other way. Please steer left. look at these social services that we're offering you. Look at these ways we can do to help you to try to get you away from this and stop making poor decisions. Or B, if you continue down this road and you want to put a gun in your hand and you want to commit a felony or a violent crime against one of our community members, then we're going to come after you full force. So it's a way of putting people on alert, offering those alternatives. Now, they're going to hear us. Whether they listen to us is a different point. And that's where Reggie and his groups can go out there and they can reach those people and they can listen to them. Hopefully the message is similar to what we're saying, because the bottom line is we want to stop the violence. We want to give people alternatives so they don't continue down this road. But if they are going to be out there and they are going to be committing violence, then they're going to get caught up with it and they're going to, you know, have to be held accountable for their actions.
Chief, it also sounds like as you talk about this and you talk about those customs notifications, I imagine then a lot of the success of that depends on your guys who are on the beat, the men and women who are working that neighborhood and developing those relationships with people in specific neighborhoods and in specific communities. Do you feel like those relationships are happening? Because a lot of that, to me, it sounds like with your custom notification system, you do need people who kind of know each other, who are seeing each other on a daily basis.
Well, yes, they do play a role in it, but the bigger role is in the family and the loved ones who can be influential over these people on a 24/7 basis versus my officers making contact with them, you know, once every few days. It has to be the family that comes forward and cares enough. You know, these people aren't just children either. That's what we need to talk about here. We have them ranging from ages of 12 to 30 something. So there's some, you know, as some adults that are involved in this that are definitely influential over these young men's life, and they may not have the best motives for some of these young men. So it's not just one, you know, a 12 to 16 year old. There's also some adults that are involved in this nonsense, and that we need to get them on board as well. And so whether or not they come on board or not is their choice. What we are basically doing is laying out a path for them, one of two paths, and hopefully they'll take the path where basically they change their life and they move on. But they're going to need a support system. That support system is going to be involving our community as a whole, but more importantly, their family, the people that are influential, their grandparents, maybe a best friend, maybe a male role model, people who can talk to them. You know, it may be somebody like Reggie who can talk to them from don't make the same mistakes I've made, blah, blah, blah. But if you're going to continue down this violent path, then you're going to have to be held accountable for your actions, period.
Thanks for that, Chief Winslow. Mayor Langfelder, let's end this conversation with you. I just want to ask if Springfield's, I know there are models of other ways that communities, Peoria has the Don't Shoot program, Champaign-Urbana has CU Fresh Start. That's based on a national model out of North Carolina. We're going to be looking at those later on throughout the summer. Mayor, are you all thinking about programs like that as well?
Yeah, actually, that's what the chief was referring to. It's similar to ours, is focused deterrence, where we're working with the county, Sangamon County Sheriff's Department, State's Attorney, U.S. Marshal, U.S. Attorney's Office, things of that nature. And so the chief's taking the lead. We did receive a grant for that, but it's identifying individuals that you know, are susceptible to engaging in these activities. So we're rolling out pieces quicker than we anticipated, but this is something that's building upon the police actions. But really, as a community, how you tie all this together, because it is a community problem, how can we come together to address it? And really, we have a lot of great non-for-profits that, you know, I explained it. It's like we have a puzzle that we want our city to become. We all want a safe neighborhood to live in. We want our city to be safe. So there's different pieces of the puzzle, and that's what each nonprofit brings to the table. So Reggie and Cujo, they deal with the extreme individuals that you need to bring into the fold or try to get them on the right path. Then you have others, Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, and they have different levels of outreach. We have the outlet that deals with male juveniles, that making sure that they don't go down the wrong path, and a lot of other great groups. But each one has a role to play. It's up to us as a city government to try to bring all the pieces together and how we can best work together on scarce resources to address the issue at hand. So some of the initiatives we are taking a look at is activities at nighttime, you know, 6 to 10 o'clock range, where we don't have that offering. That's one of the gaps we need to address, as well as the ones from 12 to 15. They can't apply for jobs. You know, they're too young. So is there a way we can, you know, working through the Mr. Alliance or another group, give them a small stipend or something of that nature. So they do have a little bit of money at the end of the week in their pocket, but also learn some career activities or some just some general conflict resolutions or things of that nature that teaches them a better path or a way to make better decisions. But that's how we'll work together, bring everybody together to make sure that our future, our youth, have the best intentions as we move forward as one community.
Let's hope all of that leads to a safe summer for folks in Springfield. I want to thank Mayor Jim Langfelder for taking the time to join us, along with the chief of Springfield's Police Department, Ken Winslow, and thank community activists as well, Reggie Dale. He's an organizer with Faith Coalition for the Common Good. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. We all know that trees release oxygen and keep our air clean, but a group in Chicago has just published research out today that says benefits are so much more than that, everything from our health to even possibly having an effect on crime. We're joined on the line now by Lydia Scott. She's the director of the Chicago Region Trees Initiative, which is led by the Morton Arboretum. Lydia, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What does the Chicago Region Trees Initiative do?
The Chicago Region Trees Initiative is focused on improving the health of the urban forest to improve our quality of life. So we have four main goals that we're working on: increasing canopy cover, improving and preserving our oak ecosystems across the northeastern Illinois, but it is also an issue throughout the state, reducing the impact of invasive species, and helping people understand the value of trees.
I know one of the first cities that used your research was Dalton, Illinois. That's about 20 miles south of Chicago. What did Dalton find out through your data?
Well, Dalton is interesting because of the lack of resources within their community, they didn't have any kind of a vision, really, about their trees. They knew on a tree-by-tree basis, but when you look at them collectively from a canopy standpoint, sort of a bird's-eye view, they found that they have 26% canopy in their community, and many of those are older trees that are reaching maturity and are starting to decline. So by working with them, we're helping bring to their attention the state of their urban forest and obviously the many benefits that trees can provide. And you mentioned a few of those at the beginning of the piece here, one of the things that they're concerned about is engaging their residents, reducing crime in their neighborhoods, improving the property values in their community. And we can show them through the canopy analysis how their trees are working within their community. One thing that we've been actually able to do for them that helps them greatly is get them an inventory. So working with Ball State University and DePaul University, we're getting them a tree inventory that will enable them to begin to understand the species diversity within their community. And the reason that is so important is because when we just lost these 13 million ash trees in the Chicago region,
that was because of the
emerald ash borer. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. We know that about 19% of street trees are ash trees, but we also know that 32% of street trees are maple trees. And so while we lost 13 million ash trees across the region, if something comes in and impacts our maples, we'll have a lot more problems. Hmm. So by helping them understand their species diversity, they can learn what species they should be planting in order to reduce their risks from these kinds of impacts while improving the health of their trees as they move forward.
You know, we have just less than a minute left. I just wonder, you're hoping this research is specifically for the Chicagoland area, right, in terms of different communities accessing?
The detail, yes, is for the seven-county Chicago region.
And what do you, just very briefly, we just have just less than a minute left, what are you hoping this research can do apart from what you've already described?
Well, it enables each community to identify what their canopy is, and if we have an inventory for them, it enables them to see what their species diversity is. But what they need to really understand is that 70% of their trees are on private property. So each individual homeowner has a tree on their property that's having a big impact on their community, and everybody needs to be engaged in understanding and improving the health of our urban forest.
Well, Lydia, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to tweet out all of that information about your research. It's also going to be our website, so individual tree owners can learn a little bit more about that. But I want to thank Lydia Scott. Thanks for being with me, Lydia. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's the Chicago Region Trees Initiative led by the Morton Arboretum. We'll tweet that out. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For more than 2 years, Illinois lawmakers have been trying to reach an agreement on a budget. Illinois isn't alone. Other states have had budget impasses before after lawmakers failed to reach agreements on spending plans. The real story is, of course, just how long we've gone without a budget. If you are keeping count, we are at 712 days. Longest any state's gone without a budget since the Great Depression. So reports the Chicago Magazine, Yannick Kunichoff last week wrote a story that looked at two different approaches other states have taken to fixing their state's budgets. We spent a lot of time on this show talking about how the budget crisis has affected different parts of the state, whether it's drug treatment facilities, domestic violence shelters, to public universities, some of which were downgraded to junk status on Friday. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes, too, with Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. First, though, we wanted to take a look at other states, what they did to break their gridlock and come up with spending plans. Yana, the reporter who wrote that story, looking at all of this for Chicago Magazine, is with us now. Welcome to the 21st.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yana, you looked at a few other states in similar situations. Where did you look particularly?
Yeah, I looked at Kansas and Minnesota, which are interesting because they kind of represent the two poles of the debate that we're having in Illinois. So they've seen the most representative.
Yeah, let's start with Kansas. What happened there?
Yeah, so Kansas was, you know, kind of like a lot of states had been hit by the 2008 recession, was having a hard time, you know, was dealing with foreclosure and revenue shortfalls. And a new governor came in and decided that the way to deal with these shortfalls was going to be to cut taxes. So that would encourage more businesses to come in. It would increase employment. And then from there, the economy would grow. So this is really similar to the position the Governor Rauner has taken for what could be a solution to in Illinois. So they did cut the income tax rate. They stopped taxing a certain kind of business profit. And then a few years later, they first passed this in 2011, 2012, and then in 2013, again, slashed income taxes.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, but it sounds like I'm waiting for it sounds like that went a lot easier for Kansas's governor than it's been going for Governor Rauner, obviously, who has had his own ideas when he came in about how he wanted to improve the state's economic, the state's economy.
Yeah, Kansas is a pretty red state, and I think there were some dissenting voices, but for the most part, the governor at the time was able to put in his plan kind of in a big way, which is partially what makes it such a great example, that he was able to kind of fully implement all these pretty extreme tax-cutting measures. And I think, it's actually considered one of the largest tax cuts that any state has ever put into effect.
And because it sounds like in the specific example of Kansas, the legislature was largely also Republican and went along with these.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And what about in Minnesota? What kind of conflict did Minnesota have in terms of Minnesota didn't technically have an actual budget impasse where they didn't go without a budget, right?
So Minnesota did for a little bit. Their government only shut down for 20 days.
20 days.
2011. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, so relatively small. But they also, again, were having a lot of revenue problems, and they were looking for a solution. And they had just come off a governor who also had kind of not been pro-taxation. So the new Democratic governor that came in around 2012 decided that they were going to go the opposite way of Kansas. So they raised income taxes on high earners, they increased the minimum wage, and kind of hoped that those two pretty big policy changes would help them out later down the road.
And right, so we have Minnesota raising its taxes, and again, it's sort of a similar in terms of there's always the issue with a budget, right, with revenue and with spending. Mm-hmm. Minnesota raised its taxes, Kansas cut taxes. I wonder if, because this was a couple of years ago, if it's possible to say which approach worked and which didn't?
Yeah, so there have been some kind of clear outcomes from both of these approaches. So in Kansas, it didn't seem to go as well. So now in 2017, there was $570 million less in its general fund than in 2012. They are also, the state is in court over the funding of its public schools, which are at unconstitutional levels. There's also been slow economic growth. So Kansas is overall struggling, and actually at the moment is just in these last few weeks is caught in a budget impasse because, again, there's really short revenue and there's kind of a pressing question for what lawmakers will do next. Minnesota is kind of on the other side of the track. So they have a $2 billion budget surplus. They're planning to make full-day kindergarten available around the state. And the discussion is really about what they're going to do with the extra money that they were able to take in from taxes. There have been some reports that showed that businesses left Minnesota or that wealthier people left Minnesota after the rise in income taxes, but overall the state is doing better.
And so Kansas, that's Governor Sam Brownback. He's still the governor of Kansas, right? And Minnesota.
Yeah.
You said Kansas right now is having a little bit of a problem with trying to get agreement on a budget?
Yeah. As far as I understand it right now, it's kind of a somewhat similar situation to Illinois, that there's a revenue shortfall. There's not an immediate plan to fix that, and lawmakers can't agree on how to move forward.
That's Chicago Magazine reporter Yana Kunichoff, who wrote a story looking at Kansas and Minnesota. We'll tweet that out. I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. On Mondays, we always talk Illinois politics with Illinois reporters, and we've folded this conversation into that. I wanted to bring in a familiar voice to our listeners, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey. Brian, hey, welcome back to the 21st.
Hello, Nyla.
Good morning. So as you've been listening to this, I wonder, it's probably not as simple to say as if Illinois just needs to raise or cut taxes, as we've been having this conversation about how Kansas and Minnesota handle both their spending and revenue situations.
I mean, there are people who will say it is that simple because basically we are spending a lot more money than we're taking in right now. And so one of the ways to solve that would be to, in fact, raise taxes. That's an argument you'll hear from primarily Democrats, but also you do hear some Republicans acknowledge that that's what Illinois needs to do. But in some ways, we have kind of mirrored the Kansas experiment here in Illinois, just without really doing it quite as intentionally as they did. Of course, Governor Rauner campaigned on, we had a temporary tax increase for 4 years. He campaigned on letting that expire. It did expire. So we had a tax cut that took effect just a couple of weeks before he took office. And then the problem is, just like in Kansas, we didn't really design state government spending around those lower revenues the way we should have. In the case of Kansas, I'm not as familiar with the details of their budget making process. They did pass budgets, though. We in Illinois, by not passing budgets for the most part, and instead allowing courts to dictate a lot of our spending, are spending wildly out of control and much more money than we're taking in. And there are people now who say that, you know, the damage being done to our state's economy is much greater than any benefit we are getting from those lower tax rates.
We're
because
gonna
of the uncertainty.
Sure, Brian. We're going to get to some of that damage in a minute. Yana, let me just ask you, in Illinois, there are different ways, and we've talked to folks. We've had folks on the 21st, like Lawrence Massal from the Civic Federation. I know you talked to other people like Ralph Martiri about what recommendations for Illinois to create revenue and pay off our $14.6 billion in unpaid bills. What are tax experts here saying?
So the folks that I talked to, for the most part, fall on the side of finding some way to raise revenue. So that's from changing our flat income tax to a graduated income tax,
adding additional services like luxury services onto the state sales tax where they're not available right now. There is also a group kind of primarily leaning to the left that wants to tax financial instruments. Democrats are talking about a gambling tax, but most of the folks that I talk to are on the side of finding an additional way to bring in revenue rather than, you know, perhaps somewhere like the Illinois Policy Institute, which again wants to go more towards the way of Kansas and freeze taxes with the hope of encouraging businesses to come into the state.
So since we're talking about Kansas, Brian, I wanted to ask you, you know, Nyana mentioned the what's going on there 5 days ago. I think it would be accurate to say that lawmakers panicked after their state faced a $900 million budget gap. They overrode the governor's veto that aimed to cut more taxes. We owe $14.6 billion. Why does there seem to be no panicking here? What's your sense, Brian?
I wouldn't say it's fair to say there's no panicking. I think there's panicking in a lot of quarters. There's panicking last week.
I guess lawmaker panic. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's certainly panic among social service providers and higher education institutions. I think there are lawmakers who are panicking, too, just not a majority of them, and certainly not a veto-proof majority that it would take. And right now, people are staying in their corners still, and the leaders are continuing to dominate. So on the Republican side, Governor Bruce Rauner has tight control. He doesn't like the deals that the Democrats have offered in terms of the so-called grand bargain that came out of the Senate this spring, said it didn't go far enough for the amount of taxes that they wanted to raise that they say was necessary to balance the budget. And in the House, we've seen Democrats seemingly sticking with Speaker Madigan, and he has come out and said there's just not enough votes for a tax increase yet, especially one that the governor is not and Republicans are not signed on board to. So I wouldn't say there's not panic. There's just still more fear of both voters and the leaders at this point.
And you mentioned the damage, Brian. When we talk about the cost of this, on Friday, seven Illinois universities were downgraded, five to junk status. What did Moody say in its downgrade, Brian?
It basically says that higher education is facing a real liquidity crisis, which is financial speak for not having enough cash around, and especially at the regional directional universities, Eastern, Southern, Western, they're seeing declining enrollments. And without any sort of investment or hope on the horizon for a state budget infusion, then they're not looking at any way to improve their lot in life in the near term.
Right. I should mention, so those five universities downgraded to junk status, Southern Illinois University, Northern Illinois University, Northeastern, Eastern, Governor State. University of Illinois was also downgraded, but remains the strongest. I should add a disclaimer to everybody listening, everyone at Illinois Public Media, this station that produces the 21st. We are all University of Illinois employees. Brian, U of I was downgraded, but remains the strongest. How are the larger tier institutions looking from credit status ratings?
I mean, the bigger institutions, and I, too, work for a station that's part of the University of Illinois system.
Sorry, I should have added you in there, too, Brian.
Yeah, that's all right. University of Illinois is a tier one research university. It has a lot of grant money coming in. It has a lot of tuition money coming in. It's still a sought after place to go. We do have a lot of foreign students who come here and a lot of them have their governments paying their tuition out of state at full cost. So the U of I does have a lot of other sources of revenue, although, frankly, even that story is something that could be changing as we continue to see the change in temperature and immigration policy from the federal level potentially cooling that trend a little bit. So U of I is a little bit more robust. Illinois State is as well. But they too say they are reaching, danger points where they're, going to have to reevaluate programs potentially in the future if the state does not step up.
And one last credit question for you. Of course, if people missed it last week, predictably, the state's credit rating was again downgraded, not to junk status, but pretty close, Brian.
Yeah, that's right. It's one notch above. The next tipping point or potential notice seems to be at the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th, the end of the day that day. They have basically all but said, we're going to put you on junk status. The question is, does this really move anything? I mean, politicians love to talk about, Governor Bruce Rauner, when he was campaigning, said, oh, isn't it terrible? Look at how bad our credit ratings are. Now that he's the governor, you don't hear him talking as much about that. I'm not sure that this really moves voters that much. And, you know, there are people who will say, look, the state is not going to default on its bonds. This is, you know, about the most important thing that that you can do in turn. You know, no state has defaulted in a very long time. Illinois hasn't since the 1800s. That this is sort of posturing on the part of the bond rating agencies. But it remains to be seen. And I have a real questions about whether this actually moves anything, this particular aspect of the budget shutdown. There are a series of court cases that I think do have the potential to force some action here. But the bond ratings, I'm not convinced of that.
Right. And of course, I'm not suggesting that, right, the state would default on that. But I think also 2 years ago, no one would have said we'd be in this situation. Right, Brian? So we'll have to leave it at that. Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey, I want to thank him. I also want to thank Chicago Magazine's Yana Kunichoff. We will tweet out Yana's story. If you want to see that, follow us at 21ST Show. That's our handle. Yana, Brian, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
That's all the time we have for today. As I said, go to 21stshow.org also for all of those resources that we talked about. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.